school, the planet had become wealthier. Now, not a child was born in Kalu who couldn't afford the cube. Some critics say this was deliberate, so that Siotra and the Uniforce could spy through the network. But most people thought only of their own comfort and convenience. With Siotra on the throne, the stability of the galaxy is at stake. Surely even you can understand that. He picked up the pill, holding it out to her. The Order can protect you, long enough to gather public support, to rout out the traitors and return you to the throne. To do that, you have to stay alive. Rhee took the pill from Dallin's hand once again. Her own palms felt sweaty. She knew he was right. If the Ta'an bloodline died out, so did the validity of the Ernu Treaty. There would be nothing to stop Kalu and Fontis from going to war again, and from dragging the rest of the universe into the conflict. I'll take this on one condition. Dallin's expression remained flat. Which is? I want to go after Siotra first. A flower bloomed within seconds off the side of the stump she sat upon, and angled itself up to her. Go after the regent himself? The celebrated war veteran who wants you dead? He asked. Rhee couldn't tell if he was mocking her, or if he was simply intrigued by the idea. Isn't it enough that he is trying to kill you? Why seek him out? Why give him the chance? If he's trying to kill me, Rhiannon said, he won't expect me to come looking for him. Dallin squinted at her, and for a moment he looked almost impressed. He's not without his own contingent of Tassin. I understand that all the important collusion officials have escorts. We'll have to figure out a way around them, Rhiannon said, hoping she sounded more confident than she felt. He tapped his fingers across the wooden console. It was practically the first human gesture she'd seen from him. In the hours she'd known him, he'd been all straight lines and sharp movements. She saw in detail the ring she'd noticed when he was fighting Vayron. The outline of a horned animal was etched into its black metal. She wondered if it was another religious relic. Dallin started to speak, but just then, a red light began to blink on the screen of his console. What's that? She asked. Rhee saw they were approaching the outer belt, near Dembos and the remains of Rheta. What's happening? A red blinking light was never good. It's a checkpoint, he said tersely. Their pod shuddered violently, and the pill fell from Rhee's hand and through the grating. She dropped to her knees and peered through the metal slats to see where it had rolled. A low beep sounded through the bridge. The unfurled leaves and open flowers closed up into tight buds and retreated toward the walls. They've locked a grav beam on us. Dallin was losing his cool. We're being hailed. I thought you said we were undetectable. Panic was drilling through Rhiannon's blood like a secondary pulse. We were, he said. At least, we used to be. He shook his head. The Uniforce must have upgraded their systems. Dallin held a finger to his lips, indicating silence. He pressed the comm link on the console. This is the Genoma. Answering hail 2787 from Denbos. Over, he said. He spoke in Kalu, the official language of the Uniforce. Genoma, this is Denbos, a male voice said. He had a twang that Rhee would have placed from the southern hemisphere of her planet. You're flying in collusion airspace. We've instituted a mandatory checkpoint across the southern belt. Your vessel is unscannable. Looks like organic matter. Either way, we're going to have to board. Over. I regret to tell you that's not possible. This is actually a Fontesian vessel, composed of organic matter from the sacred forest of Dina, Dallin said, sounding light and self-assured, as if he weren't harboring an escaped princess. According to the Ernu Treaty, Article 9, these vessels are under religious protection. Over. Genoma, please be advised that Kalu has declared martial law, Boarding your vessel in 3 minutes. Cooperation mandatory. Over. The transmission went static, and the ship shuddered once more. The Dembos grav beam was pulling them in.
Martial law? Rhee repeated.
Dalin's blonde eyebrows angled down toward his nose. His complexion was ashen.
It means your military can use force.
Use force and suspend certain civil liberties in periods of war or civil unrest, she said impatiently. I know what it means. Everyone always expected princesses to know nothing except how to bow and smile and curtsy.
Martial law hasn't been declared since the start of the Great War.
She trailed off, because suddenly she understood. Martial law meant that Kalu was preparing for war. Chapter 6 Alyosha.
Come on, come on, come on!
Alyosha muttered. Air whipped up through the overhead vent as soon as the bay door sealed behind him. He needed to get to Vincent, but the revolutionary was as old as dirt. The airlock took forever to stabilize. His suit was a one-man sauna. Sweat stung his eyes. His tank top was plastered to his chest and back. The visor of his helmet had fogged up so that he could barely see. Even after all these years, the airlock freaked him out. He'd never gotten used to the change in pressure. Never could shake the feeling that a giant with a vacuum was up there, sticking it to him. But what was worse was the suctioning sound. Loud, vicious. Like something had crawled into his ear and was pulling out his soul. Soul. A word hardly anyone on Kalu used. The truth was, he still thought about his soul, a lot. Blame it on all those years of prayer. They were all the same. Dark, drooping tents, with a Fontesian preacher front and center, while he riled up the Raetan folks to praise Vadhan. An impossible, stifling heat that left Ali feeling like he'd spent the entire service 3 inches from a bonfire. But if Ali stayed very still, if he behaved, if he didn't fidget, maybe he'd have a cushy afterlife. That's what he'd been told, at least. He'd believed it for a long time, too, back when he still prayed, and back when he believed in a lot of things. He looked up at the thought of heaven, a force of habit he didn't think he'd ever shake. Instead of the divine, all he saw was a vent working overtime. He willed himself to forget the noise, but in that muted space his thoughts became crowded. The image of the old now Fruman came to mind. It wasn't so much the blood that bothered him. Ali could handle that. No. It had been the little red handprints on the Naui's wrinkled shirt and that long black braid placed across his chest. The light mount on the wall switched from red to green, and the inner door of the chamber finally creaked open. He pushed the helmet off and threw up in a trash can. Relief was short-lived. He gulped at a breath of recycled air, his stomach clenched a second time, and he purged himself again. He looked up, suddenly self-conscious that the daisies would zoom in and catch him puking his guts out. Way worse than getting caught with his pants down, which had happened plenty of times. But then, he remembered they'd stopped broadcasting.
Then,
Ali said into his cube. He caught the pitch of his own voice, rusty, like it needed oiling.
Get out here! Suit up! Over!
Pavel rolled toward him. A panel opened at the top of his domed figure, and dozens of magnetized pieces emerged. Stacking and clicking into place, the droid extended to his full height, just short of Ali's waist. Ali nodded at him distractedly. He'd programmed the droid to detect subtle motions. Greetings like nods and waves, disappointment like a head shake or crossed arms. Pavel blinked his blue eyelights in response.
Did you get my hail? Ali asked.
I went into sleep mode during the upgrade. His eyelights went red. I did not see any incoming messages.
Vincent!
Allie said again, touching the spot just below his ear. Silence. He wondered if Vin still felt weird about how they'd left it earlier.
Where is he?
Heat signature reads his bedroom, said Pavel. Pulse is low. Delta waves have slowed.
Are you telling me he's asleep?
So much for morning. He's likely in NREM, stage 3 of the sleep cycle. Humans often...
Hold that thought, P, Allie interrupted.
Vin, wake up!
He yelled a string of what he thought were particularly colorful insults into his cube and threw in some ratin' ones for good measure. He could say whatever he wanted with the daisies off, but his whole rant was met with more silence. Allie found his rhythm despite the bulk of his suit. Pavel enabled his density mode and rolled closely behind him. Slipping and sliding, Allie finally reached Vincent's threshold and burst through his door. His cramped room was a disaster zone. Vin was still in bed. He kicked his way through the piles of clothes.
Get up, Tahi's face!
Allie hopped over a gadget he didn't recognize.
One of Vin's new projects, probably.
I found an escape pod from the royal ship.
Allie Osha, Pavel started.
Look, I'm sorry for being kind of pissed earlier, but we gotta go. Rise and shine, you lazy son of a chartwa.
Vin had made Allie teach him a bunch of Raten curse words. And that one was his favorite. He flung the sheet off him. But Vincent wasn't there. All he found was a pillow and some balled-up clothes.
What the hell was going on?
Pavel,
he called back to the droid.
You said you read a heat source?
From under his base, Pavel switched out the wide treadmill wheel to two large all-terrain ones, then climbed the stacks of clothes to stand in the center of the tiny room. His dome rotated in a circle as he scanned. Then he extended an arm and picked up a gray cylinder, the gadget Allie had stepped over to get to the bed.
It's some kind of external heat device, the droid said.
The pressure felt like too much. Like everything was bearing down on him. He didn't know what to do. He looked around the room. Really looked. For the first time. Vin had always been messy. But this was different. All of his drawers had been pulled out and emptied on the floor. Tiny machine parts were scattered everywhere. Everything that had been up on his bulletin board was torn down. Someone had searched Vincent's room, it seemed. But who? And what had happened to Vincent?
Allie felt cold.
Vin had disappeared just after Allie had found the royal escape pod and sent out a hail across an open cube channel. It couldn't be a coincidence.
Who else is on board? He asked Pavel.
Pavel looked distressed, for a droid at least.
I detect no additional heat signatures.
So Vincent had left. Or had been taken. Allie felt a quake starting inside his chest. With a sweep of his arm, he sent everything on the desk flying. A familiar hammer landed on the floor. It was his. Vin was always stealing his tools. He could never keep track of his own. They'd gotten into a fistfight over it once. He suddenly regretted how stupid he'd been. He should have just given it to him.
Cube transmissions are scrambled. Pavel said flatly. Something is wrong.
No Tahi's something is wrong.
But at that moment, he saw a shadow eclipse the doorway. A humanoid droid, tall and shiny, made of a high-grade alloy. Military-grade alloy. It was the NX series, but from a model that hadn't yet been released. Allie didn't know why or how it had boarded the Revolutionary, but it stood at least 8 feet tall and had to duck through the doorway. Technically, he and the NX droid were both soldiers for the Uniforce. They were on the same side. So why did Allie suddenly want to piss his pants?
Private Alyosha Miraz, it said, scanning his vitals. Its eyes flashed once and then turned red. Mark identified.
Alyosha's knees buckled. Definitely not on the same side. No wonder Pavel had detected no additional heat signatures on board. Uniforce, it had to be Uniforce, had sent a droid to do their dirty work. As the droid went for him, Ali grabbed a drawer off the floor and flung it at the NX as hard as he could, but the metal behemoth swatted it away. It smashed against the wall and splintered in two. Alyosha scrambled for more things to throw. The droid was on him quickly and kicked its heel into Ali's chest. Even with the giant suit Ali was wearing, the impact was like getting shot. He flew backward against the wall and took down the bulletin board, collapsing on the desk, gasping. The military droid took hold of Ali's leg and yanked him off the desk. Ali landed on his back on a pile of clothes, and he thanked God that Vin was such a slob. He might have broken his neck on the bare floor otherwise. And then he remembered that Vincent had taken off. A feeling wormed itself in, right there up between the pit of his stomach and the back of his heart. Not just anger or sadness, but both. A sense of the unfairness of it all. To his left, he saw the hammer, and he grabbed it before the droid could kick it away. He knew it was of no use. This model of droid couldn't even die, really. It would just reboot. Still, he whacked it blindly in the direction of the droid's control panel, roaring with sudden rage, unwilling to die in a heap of Vincent's dirty laundry. Then the droid ripped the hammer from his hand. It grabbed his neck, and Alyosha's brain blinked out. He was going to die. The droid was suddenly still. Its eyes went black. Its whole body began to spark. The terrible steel hands around Alyosha's neck released, and he sat up, coughing and gasping, massaging his throat. The droid was on its back now, twitching like a dying insect. Ali turned to Pavel, who was humming loudly in overdrive.
What did you do?
Ali asked, through the pain in his throat.
I uploaded a virus to its operating system.
The way he said it had a lilt. Ali could almost hear the shrug in his voice.
What virus?
Whatever Pavel had done, he was glad for it.
A virus I just invented. I coded it now.
Ali could have hugged him. He staggered to his feet, his head still dizzy and his chest like a bombed-out crater. But he was alive. He knew the droid was being tracked, though. All military droids were. And shorting it had made them more high-profile than ever. Military droids didn't travel solo. And reinforcements must be getting ready to storm the revolutionary now. Ali ripped out Pavel's comm unit, an external cube he had installed so the droid was wired to the network. Then he powered down his own cube and stumbled. It felt like a fist had wrapped around his brain to wring out all the juice, the connectivity. He was offline. He couldn't record anything. He couldn't look anything up. But at least their GPS would go dark. Still, they had Allie's heat signature to take care of.
Let's go, Ali said, taking one last glance at Vin's empty bed.
He grabbed the hammer off the floor, praying Vin had bolted before some titanium beast had crushed his head like a grape.
Please let Vin be okay.
Then they ran. Rather, he ran, and Pavel rolled. How much of the medical Bible do you have downloaded? He called over his shoulder.
Approximately 30%. First aid and basic surgery.
Anything on anesthesiology?
No, I'd need to go back online.
We can't go back online.
Not until they were out of danger. If they were ever out of danger. Why had Kalu's Uniforce gone on the attack? Ali knew it must be because he'd found evidence the princess might still be alive, but he was too jacked up to untangle any more of the puzzle. They entered the medbay, and Ali barred the door behind them. He tore down medicine bottles and smashed salves onto the floor until he found what he was looking for. Gel nitrogen compound. He shrugged out of the suit, then pulled off his shirt and pants and began covering his body to insulate the heat.
I need to lower my body temperature. What's the baseline so I lose my heat signature?
Below 22 degrees Celsius, you become undetectable by standard scanning techniques. But every computable attempt carries an 80% chance of fatality by hypothermia.
Not if you resuscitate me first. Allie started to cover his face and smeared a thick layer across the crown of his head, gooping it into his coarse hair. Pavel was clearly flustered. Metal attachments extended and retracted as he scanned med labs and did calculations on the fly. His movements were jerky, like the old-school service droids that worked in the Ray. Pavel held up a newly filled syringe.
If I inject cathartium into your blood, your temperature will lower down to 25 degrees, and I can resuscitate you with any of the ilium ions within 7 minutes to prevent death.
You said I had to get it down to 22 degrees.
True, Pavel said. He held up a second syringe. But the heat sensors have a margin of error. There's a 77% chance you will remain undetected.
Not good enough.
Then our only alternative is the Tori-based compound. You'll drop down to 20 degrees, but after 3 minutes, you'll suffer painful paralysis, and after 4 minutes, you will be dead. Also, the Sucra serum, meant to reverse it, is highly unstable.
What I'm hearing is, we use the Tori. You inject me with the juice, and we make a run for the escape pod.
Allie picked up the Sucra serum. It was purple, like the dawn. Last time he saw the sunrise, he'd been on leave and went to Jeth's on Charum. I strongly recommend against it, Pavel insisted now.
P, there's no other choice.
He grabbed for the second syringe and plunged it into his heart before Pavel could stop him. A black hole rose up to meet him, and he fell into it. Through the air, through the floor, into the dark space that crushed all matter. He was both trapped in the body and floating above it. His soul split in two. Then all the matter of his body recollected at this point in space and time, bouncing back in a fraction of a second. He shot up. Everything felt numb and powerful at once. He wanted to crush something with his hands, and he was suddenly angry. Really angry. He'd mow all the capital sons of Chartois down now. But when he tried to take a step, his legs wouldn't work. He would have fallen again if Pavel hadn't rolled over and buffered his fall. Paralysis set in early, 3 minutes and 20 seconds out. He was draped over Pavel now, his feet dragging behind them. He walked, or tried to, which meant that he kicked his feet out weakly and focused on the hum of Pavel's wheels. They had exited the medbay, and he was cold, shivering, teeth-chattering cold. Allie, your heat signature is now undetectable. Answer if you can hear me. He let out a groan. 2 minutes and 45 seconds out. Irreversible damage will set in soon. On your order, I will inject the serum.
The serum? It sounded familiar. Urgent, even. Like a very important part of a very important plan they'd discussed. But what plan, Allie couldn't quite recall.
I believe you are experiencing temporary memory loss. It may mean your brain is being deprived of oxygen.
But no. Could remember. He was back in school with a Fontesian missionary trying to pronounce Vadhan's name for the first time, and how weird the word felt in his mouth, all the sharp syllables rolling off his tongue in exactly the wrong way. Still, he'd liked the idea of one God, one master plan. Sometimes it still felt like Vadhan talked to him in whispers, and he felt just a little bit lighter and a little bit less alone.
Do you see a light, Allie? If so, Be aware it is an electrical surge in your brain, and it means you will likely die.
You're a bummer, Pavel.
Allie's jaw felt heavy, his tongue swollen to 3 times its size.
I can't bring you anywhere.
Good, Alyosha. Attempts at humor mean the frontal cortex is still intact. 2 minutes and 15 seconds out. But just then, Pavel came to an abrupt halt. I detect movement. Pavel backtracked through the hallway toward the access ladder that led down to the engine room. A temporary solution, the droid said in a low voice. Based on your bone density and the height of the fall, you should not sustain serious injuries.
Fall? He asked,
even as Pavel laid him down and rolled around behind his shoulders.
What fall?
The droid pushed. Allie dropped. When he slammed against the ground, his head hit the grating and he saw stars. But it didn't hurt. Nothing hurt. It was only cold. He thought of the day they'd gotten the news that his mom and Alina had died. He saw his dad standing over him all over again. Be a man, he was saying. Be a man. 2 minutes out, Pavel called down to him. His voice at the top of the ladder sounded tinny. Allie realized where he was, steps away from the engine room. Then Pavel disappeared.
No!
He tried to yell, but his mouth wasn't working anymore. He was alone, shivering, his head busted open. How exactly did he get here? He'd never seen snow, but this was what it must feel like to be buried in it. Even his brain was freezing over. Memories flashed from his life, walking alongside his dad, water dripping off a corrugated metal roof. Someone was coming toward them, but he couldn't remember who or why. They were on their way to fly a kite. Allie slipped out of consciousness and then woke again. How long had it been? A second? An hour? He heard the NX marching. The hiss and zip of expensive hydraulics boiled the blood in his heart. He was 7. His dad's enormous hand pawed at his shirt and pulled him close. Don't speak unless spoken to, and don't say anything smart. His dad had whispered the last word like it was something foul, shameful. A Fontesian was passing. But he wasn't like the missionaries who taught Vodhan's word in the droopy makeshift prayer tents. The Fontesians were generally larger, with pale skin and pointy ears that kids would whisper about. It was rumored they could hear anything, anywhere. But this particular man had dark tattoos all along his neck that looked like they were clawing their way out from under his shift.
What's this?
The Fontesian had asked as he grabbed roughly for their kite. Allie was too scared to speak, and the man had repeated himself, this time, in Raten. He'd accented it in all the wrong places, and when his dad told him it was a kite they'd made together, the Fontesian's answer was cold.
There is only one way to get to heaven, and it is not by flying.
Now Allie felt the cool grate against his face. How much time had passed? More than 2 minutes, he was sure. He was going to die. Maybe he was dead already. He could still feel the rain from when he'd been tossed outside all those years ago. In his mouth, on his eyelids, sliding down around his ears. It was like the water had been gathering all these years. Between then and now, rising. Then, it swallowed him up, and everything was quiet. Chapter 7 Rhiannon. The Uniforce soldiers would board any second, and Rhi could no longer trust they would protect her.
Take the pill. The scrambler takes up to a minute to work, Dallin said. There was a new sense of urgency in his voice.
I've lost it,
Rhee peered through the grate into the darkness. She'd made a mess of everything.
Help me get the grate up!
He cursed in Fontesian. There's no time, he said. He went to the wall and slid his fingers along its gnarled surface. He found what he was looking for, the opening of a hatch that had been invisible. He motioned for Rhee to crawl inside. When the hatch closed behind her, everything went dark. But it didn't go still. The bark shifted under Rhee's weight, poking and prodding her as she tried to get comfortable. She knew the ship was alive. It was organic matter, after all. But she hadn't expected it to squirm and wiggle. She felt sick, like she'd digested something rotten. No, like she was being digested. Outside, the ship had settled into a grav beam, and she heard the bay doors open. Dallin offered strained greetings, and Rhee felt the weight of the craft tip as though several soldiers had come on board at once.
"Sergeant Nature," a man said, introducing himself. "Just a routine sweep. Interesting vessel."
"I've never seen this kind of droid before," Dallin said. Rhee heard the zip and hiss of a machine sweeping across the small pod. Something cracked.
"It's pretty, certainly, but can it be more careful?" "I'm sorry, sir," the sergeant said in a tone that suggested he was not sorry at all. "These NX combat droids haven't been programmed for a soft touch. Sooner we're done, sooner it's off."
"Of course," Dallin answered. "Can you tell me, Sergeant, when martial law was declared?"
A tense silence followed. Rhee figured this Nietzsche character must not like being questioned, even if the question itself was a reasonable one.
"Since riots broke out across all of Kalu, that's when," the man said roughly. "Lots of people devastated by the princess's death, and lots of people wondering exactly who's responsible. Like the Allies don't have enough problems, enough dusties to choke off whatever resources they have left."
Rhee heard a long pause, and she wondered what had been communicated in that silence. She was worried about the riots. She'd have to check the hollows next time she got the chance. As the droid moved closer, Rhee hugged herself and, as if in response, the wooden walls of the ship enfolded her even more tightly. As she waited in the darkness, Rhee thought of when she'd explored the sand caves with Julian. His crooked smile when he looked at her. The rough stone walls against the skin of her palm. It was the first time they'd ever done a cube-to-cube transfer. She'd felt goosebumps, seeing and feeling his life through his memory. Now, without her cube, even this memory was gone. Distorted, like all organic memories were. The cave walls closed in, and all she felt was terror. Rhee urged her mind to somewhere calm, and a new memory emerged, a game of hide-and-seek with Jocelyn, the time she'd gotten lost in the cellars. Her parents had thought it was filthy down there and never uploaded the layout to her cube to prevent her from exploring the tunnels. She'd been down there for hours, blinded by the torchlight when Joss had finally found her. Relief and shame clutching at her insides as she hid her face so her big sister wouldn't see her tears.
"The material makes heat signatures impossible to detect," the sergeant continued.
Rhee placed her hand against the wood as if to thank it. She knew so little about Fontesian tech.
"You'll have to enable your cube playback for us."
"I'm from a Fontesian order," Dallin said. "I turned off my cube once I took my vows. It's against our practices."
She could tell now that the calmer he sounded, the more annoyed he really was. The sergeant grunted.
"Fontesians, sure. The great Vaudhan, I've heard. Freedom to practice and all that is fine and good, but since you don't have playback, we'll need to ask you some questions. NX-101, enable interrogation."
"Interrogation mode enabled, level 6.
"Dallin of Fontis," the sergeant said, "what is your directive?
Missionary work, Dallin said evenly.
Affirmative, the droid said.
My brother fought in the war. He was stationed at Yarazu and said you lot don't feel pain.
Should we test his theory? The man asked casually.
Then, after a silence,
break his finger anyway.
Rhee brought a fist to her mouth as she heard a terrible snap and wondered if the droid had done what it was asked. Dallin had not cried out in pain. The walls around her shifted and contorted her into a new position, pushing her leg at an awkward angle.
In hindsight, we should have avoided the ring finger. It will prove difficult to remove,
Nietzsche said without emotion.
Next question. Are you sympathetic to the royal family of Kalu?
Of course, Dallin said. She thought she could hear a slight strain in his voice. The last Ta'an girl has just died.
She shivered, despite herself. It was strange to hear him talk about her like she was already a ghost.
Let me rephrase. Do you support the Urnu Treaty?
I'm not a political man.
Let me guess. You're a man of God, the sergeant said, his voice dripping sarcasm. Next question.
But his voice trailed off, and a terrible silence hung for a minute. When the sergeant spoke again, his voice was very soft.
Interesting piece. Is it silver?
Rhee's heart seized. Julian's telescope. She'd left it on the console. The sergeant continued in that soft, falsely courteous voice.
I thought your kind was too good to mine sacred metals. Where did you get this?
After a short pause, Dallin said,
It was a gift.
The soldier droid whirred in the silence.
Negative.
Ha!
The instructor paused, a sneer in his voice.
Why lie about a telescope? Robot, second finger.
Another sound like the harsh crack of a whip. Rhee flinched as nausea rose in her throat. Dallin only exhaled, a small sigh.
How long could this go on? How long could she let it?
The walls and floor around her shifted again angrily, clamping down her leg. It seemed to be pulsing, as if in response to Dallin's pain and the other man's hatred. This was all her fault. It was her telescope, and if she'd just taken the scrambler, then she could have saved them both.
She heard her dad's voice. Mata'an Sarili.
Was the last thing he'd told her when he'd kissed her forehead.
Such a simple phrase, but such a tall demand. To pledge your highest self to someone else. To ask someone else to do the same.
Rhee felt for the knife and moved into a crouch. The wood released her, as if it knew her intention. She'd fled her family's ship and left them to burn up without her. Killed a man she loved like a father. She could not allow someone to die for her.
Get up,
Joss had said the day she found Rhee alone and sniveling in the cellars. She hadn't teased her or called her a baby, but Rhee had never forgotten the look on her face, as if Joss had expected more.
Get up!
Now Rhee pounded on the hatch. Outside, Dallin cried out for the first time, but she knew she had to save him.
What the...
Rhee squeezed the knife in one hand. She breathed in through her nose, out through her mouth. She imagined her muscles expanding. Focus. That's what Vayrin, dead Vayrin, traitor Vayrin, had always taught her. Too many fighters fell because they lost focus. Then there was an explosion of splintered wood as the droid burst open the compartment. Air and light flooded in. She saw Dallin restrained, staring straight at her, terrified or perhaps angry with her. It didn't matter. The droid was a newer model, made to look like a shiny metal man. It looked her up and down with its glass eye. Rhiannon Ta'an, it announced after its program had finished scanning.
Empress?
The sergeant nearly choked.
You're alive?
Then, the droid picked her up from the back of her tunic, like a mama dog picking up her pup by the scruff of the neck, and deposited her neatly in front of the sergeant. He was entirely ordinary. A paunchy Mizu with a pear-shaped body and deep yellow skin. Antennae came out of the side of his head where a human's ears would be, and the high gravity of Kalu had taken its toll. His face looked like a deflated balloon. Rhee had seen his kind countless times before. Little men who squeezed into double-breasted suits, following around some advisor or another, oozing with compliments in hopes of being welcomed into the political entourage. He was like every low-level diplomat she'd been forced to shake hands with, who were quick to point out how articulate she was for her age, or how lovely her light complexion was, as if she were incapable of detecting a backhanded compliment. Essentially, he was an idiot. He was an embarrassment to their military.
"Isn't this a pleasure?" he said with a traditional bow. "The Regent's Council will be thrilled to know you're alive."
He'd no doubt be thrilled to receive his reward.
"The pleasure is mine," she said sweetly, "but I won't be joining you."
In one smooth motion, she threw her arms up, slipping out of the oversized tunic. Still clutching the switchblade, she landed on her knees and drove the knife into the sergeant's foot with both hands. He screamed in pain. The droid grabbed her head and slammed it down to the ground, and for a split second, her vision went black. With her face against the grate, she saw a flash of red as her vision cleared.
The DNA scrambler.
The droid picked her up again. For a half a second, she was staring up into the cool indifference of its metal face. Then, she saw a flash of green. A snake? Wind around its neck and yank the droid backward, forcing it to release her. She scrambled to her feet. She saw now that Dallin had managed to wrap a vine around its steel throat. For a second, the Fontesian and the droid staggered together in a terrible dance, and the droid was squeezing Dallin's neck. Rhee was temporarily mesmerized by the sight of dozens of thick vines slithering from the wall, slowly winding their way up the droid's legs, punching through its steel plates, tightening around its thick metal waist, protecting Dallin. The scrambler. She dropped to her knees again, threading her fingers through the grate, fumbling for the pill.
"Rhee,"
Dallin managed to gasp.
"Look out!"
She turned. The sergeant had freed the knife from his foot. Now he didn't look so ordinary. She could believe he'd fought in the Great War. His eyes were cloudy with rage. He looked like a monster. How would she escape?
"You never think before you move,"
Vayrin had said. Her fingertips grazed the pill.
"One more inch."
At last she managed to get it into her palm. And before the sergeant could attack, she whipped around and kicked at his shins, cutting his legs out from under him. He slammed backward. Before he could recover, she was on top of him, disgusted by the spongy feel of his skin. When he opened his mouth to call for the droid, Rhee shoved the scrambler down his throat. She clamped his jaw shut so he couldn't spit it out. His rounded eyes went wide and he began to choke. Rhee realized in horror that the scrambler was designed for human DNA, and she didn't know what would happen. She watched as his chubby face began to lengthen, so that the tip of his chin and the top of his forehead stretched out like a piece of dough. Then it thinned out further, worn through in places, nearly transparent in others. She saw down to the bone and blood.
"Stop! Stop!"
he screamed. Even his voice was becoming distorted, as if it, too, was being stretched to the breaking point.
"Please, stop!"
True to its programming, the droid stopped struggling immediately and darkened to standby mode. The vines began to withdraw. Dallin, still breathing hard, ripped out the external comm unit mounted onto the droid's neck. It was a droid's equivalent to a cube, except the droid couldn't function without one. Dallin limped up to Rhee,
cradling his broken hand. He held out the tunic she'd shed. She wrapped it around herself, and together, they watched as the Mizu's eyes went milky. And his cries began to change, higher, then lower, like he was testing out a frequency. It was as if he were melting before her eyes, and she turned away, feeling as if she might vomit.
"It was a clever move," Dallin said.
"I didn't do it to impress you," she fired back. "I did it to save your life."
"My life is not your concern."
He reset his fingers, taking in a sharp inhale that was barely audible over the cracking of his bones. He pulled the black ring off and slipped it on the opposite finger of his good hand.
"I'm grateful to you, but you're meant to be Empress, to unify the galaxy. Your survival takes precedence over my life. It takes precedence, too, over your need to be honorable."
"I don't believe that." Honor, bravery, loyalty. These made up her Mata'an Sarili, the three values.
"You're not old enough to know what to believe," Dallin answered as he kneeled down next to Nietzsche.
As if he were that much older. Dallin began searching the sergeant's neck with one thin hand. For a confused second, Rhee thought he was checking for a pulse. Then she saw he was holding the knife.
"That's my knife," she said. Her surprise morphed into dread. He ignored her.
"Do you know where they implant cubes on the Mizu?"
He grabbed the sergeant, now horribly deformed, and jerked him up to a sitting position.
"Here, at the top of the spine."
"What are you..." she began to ask, but had to look away, as Dallin plunged the tip of the blade into the sergeant's neck and gouged out the microchip.
"He might know something of value," Dallin said simply.
Dallin cleaned the cube of a sticky white substance she assumed was Mizu blood.
"Can't you just enable playback?" she asked, knowing full well it was impossible.
There were mechanisms and fail-safes that prevented forced playback, and in any event, the holder had to be conscious.
"There's a driver embedded in the dashboard just under the console. See what you can find."
Rhee was glad for the opportunity to turn away from the mangled body of the sergeant. Whatever memories he'd willed would be lost. His family would be devastated. Rhee knew the feeling all too well, and wouldn't wish it on anyone. She located the driver and inserted the chip into it. Angry. Hopeless. Rhee wasn't sure what Dallin was trying to do. Sergeant Nietzsche's death would have triggered an automatic wipe of his memory system. Maybe the cube was outfitted with an identification number, so they could access the sergeant's files, like his military history, or who he might have been reporting to. The console lit up. The prompts and instructions were in Fontesian characters. She tried her best to navigate through the foreign characters using the touchscreen, not sure what she was looking for. She pressed a word that made the whole ship go dark, with hundreds of holograms creating a circle before her. Most of them looked like photographs, moments frozen in time, and she found herself drawn to an image of a smiling Mizu. Rhee lifted her hand up as if to touch her face, and her hand activated something on the hologram, because the woman threw her head back and her laughter filled the ship. Then she reached her arms out toward Rhee as if to hug her before the file cut out. The sergeant's mother, Rhee realized, feeling sick. There were hundreds of memories in hologram form, piled on top of one another. It was like being in the man's mind. It was being in his mind. Which was impossible unless...
He's still alive?
She asked, horrified. She turned to see Nietzsche sitting up, his back propped against the wall of vines, his features so horribly melted and disfigured he was unrecognizable.
"I'll take over from here," Dallin said, temporarily distorting the hologram as he walked through it.
"How is this possible?" Rhee asked. She was using technology that wasn't supposed to exist. It was a crime to look into someone's cube without permission. It was more than a crime. Cubes stored not just information, but memories, feelings, sensations, thought impressions.
This is wrong. This is illegal. At the G1K summit, I can't remember if it was the third or the fourth, but it was clearly forbidden by law.
Forbidden by law? Dalin tilted his head and looked at her. Through her. Have you seen what terrible things the laws of men enable?
No. She believed in the law. She believed in the laws that came out of those summits, certainly. Over the past 60 years, ever since the cube had been invented, the universe's greatest scientists had gathered at the G1K to review and regulate the interplanetary laws around its use. They were high-profile individuals, and every planet or territory inevitably plastered their names on a landmark or their faces on a digital credit. Dalin sorted through the holograms with his hands, flicking away the ones that didn't interest him. There was a pattern to it, and Rhee did her best to follow. But she couldn't make sense of another man's mind. She was curious. Ashamed, but most of all, furious. Stop this! Dalin ignored her, working in a way that was methodical and mechanical. But with every image he slid away, a seismic shudder moved through her. She was watching an entire life collapsed, and felt the weight not just of bringing the Misu to near death, but of something much worse.
It seems I'm not wrong, Dalin said. Here, look.
Buried under so many layers of memories, some fragmented and some crystalline, was a recent memory of a priority message sent to all Kalu government personnel. The hologram showed a man, his skinny lips pursed, his expression serious. Rhee's breath caught in her throat. It was Crown Regent Siotra, her father's best friend, grim-faced and power-hungry, who'd stood in the hangar and sent her family off to their deaths. Rhee had seen Siotra as she snuck off the craft, had seen the way he smiled. How many times had she replayed that memory? And a look of glee, as if he were only inches from the thing he wanted most in the world. Only hours from what he wanted most. Dalin touched the image of Siotra, and like water disturbed by a stone, it began to ripple and move.
I won't mince words. This is a dark, dark day for the galaxy.
Siotra paused and brought a closed fist to his mouth like he was desperately trying to contain emotion.
Since she was the last living member of the Ta'an dynasty, Rhiannon's death places the hard-won treaty between Fontis and Kalu at risk. But I must emphasize that even if the treaty no longer has legal validity, we still have a moral responsibility to honor its provisions.
Rhiannon's heart sank. Siotra was smart. Too smart. On the face of it, he was encouraging the Kalu to keep the peace. Between the lines, he was reminding them that with her death, the treaty that had ended the universe's bloodiest war was all but broken.
I would like to reiterate that for those of you who are so selfishly using the princess's death as an excuse to sow violence and chaos in the capital, and in order to justify your despicable acts of civil disobedience, punishment will be swift and severe.
So the sergeant had spoken the truth. There was rioting in Kalu. Her heart swelled at the thought that some people, at least, were furious about her death. But she clamped any bit of joy down quickly. What did it matter? All it meant was that there were only more deaths, this time in her name. Revealing herself now would legally reinstate the treaty. But could she wrest power away from Siotra successfully? Would her people welcome or denounce her? Would she be killed before she could get her revenge?
As of 1100 hours, martial law will be in effect across the planet. All collusion colonies and territories, and collusion-designated airspace.
Siotra brought a hand to his forehead, the first sign he'd shown of discomfort.
I'll be traveling to Tinopa to honor the princess's life and her death, at a ceremony 3 days from now, conducted by Tai Rayana, Princess Rhiannon's personal advisor.
His fingers tightened on the podium. Even in Hollow, Ree could see his knuckles whiten.
I ask you as a planet to pray for us that we will see our way out of these dark times.
Ree balled her hands so that Dallin wouldn't see they were shaking.
That hypocrite! Paying respects with the tie to win points with the interplanetary community even as he mobilizes for a war in my name? She said.
She wondered secretly if it was more than just an act. Could Ty Rayana have conspired with him?
Ree shook the thought loose, angry for even thinking it. We need to go to T'Nopa. We need to stop him.
Dallin continued to sort through more messages. Reports of a hyperloop hijacked in Uriya. An electromagnetic pulse detonated in Eurasia. An occupied embassy in Cebu. Collusion cities wrecked by havoc. Ree's anger was going to suffocate her. She reached out and pounded on the console. Dallin turned to her finally, a look on his face that bordered on boredom.
Are you listening to me?
She hissed and drew herself up a little taller.
I demand we go to Siotra.
Dallin walked through the circle of the holograms and fiddled with the navigational controls. With a graceful dip, the ship began to wheel in the sky. They were no longer heading toward Portus.
As you wish, Empress,
was all he said. Chapter 8. Alyosha. Alyosha awoke to an explosion that rocked the ship and rolled him halfway to the engine room. Pavel was back. He extended a zip line down the ladder and clamped onto the leg of Ali's suit. 53 seconds out, Pavel said, as he lifted Ali with metal hooks and dragged him down the corridor. Ali's mind was fracturing. He couldn't keep his eyes open.
Save yourself,
he wanted to say, but he couldn't make the words form.
P. What did he say?
Someone asked.
That voice. He knew it. He recognized it. But the name and the image of the guy's face came and went like something that passed in a rushing river.
Undecipherable. His vocal cords have seized, Pavel answered. He has 30 seconds left to live.
What are you waiting for?
Vincent. His friend. His best friend. Vin was back. Positioning myself for maximum velocity, Pavel answered. I'll have to puncture the chest plate. Vin grabbed the syringe from Pavel and drove it down into Allie's chest, through layers of muscle and bone. Suddenly, his heart flooded with the color purple and the rising dawn. Every muscle spasmed and he gasped for air. His body burned. Heat came back to him in the form of a fire coursing through his veins. Memories came back, a whole universe exploding inside of him. Everything he had ever known and thought.
Sorry, man, Vin said.
When he pulled back, his smile was rough around the edges. Ali didn't know if Vin was about to laugh or cry. Vin helped Ali sit up.
Where the hell did you go?
Hiding in the engine room.
Ali realized it'd been too hot for Pavel to detect Vin's heat signature down there. Why the hell hadn't Ali thought of that? Vin stood and yanked Ali up to his feet, while Ali gripped onto Vin's palm to make sure he was real.
I'm gone for 5 minutes, and you inject yourself with Tori?
Don't explain, he said, when Ali opened his mouth.
Let's get going already, before any more of those metalheads come looking. No offense, he added to Pavel.
More of those,
Ali repeated. His head still felt like it had been stuffed with cotton balls. Vin and Pavel had to support him to the tin soldier. Then, Pavel picked Ali up and strapped him in. Back again, but in the passenger seat. It was a tight fit.
The droids aren't the directive. They're just following orders, Vin said.
The directive? What are you talking about? Who's the directive?
The regent is. Siotra killed the princess, Vin said.
Simply. Just like that,
Allie thought of the dead Naoi, the princess's braid. He felt like he'd been let out of an airlock.